Welcome to Life and Limb, a podcast from Thrive Magazine, all about living well with limb loss and limb difference. I'm Jeff Thiessen, publisher of Thrive Magazine and your podcast host. My guest this episode is someone that I haven't met until a few minutes ago, but I got an email from him just recently, and I was really taken and fascinated by it. And I thought right away that Thrive Magazine readers need to know more about Jacob and how great it would be for our podcast listeners to hear his remarkable story too. So we have Jacob Koepka with us today. He's from London, Ontario, an above knee amputee, a serious cyclist, and that's an understatement for sure. And you'll understand why. And for me to share more about his vision and his life, it would not do it justice. So we're going to let Jacob do that for us too. So Jacob, welcome. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for having me today on your show or podcast.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So I said you're from London, but originally you're
from I'm from Eastern Ontario.
Right. Small town.
A small town, south of Ottawa, raised on a farm. And my parents were first generation Canadians, post Second World War refugees. My father was a Polish military man from the Second World War. Mother was a war bride of German background, and they immigrated here in the late 40s. They made Canada their home. And my sister and I were raised on the farm. My sister was born overseas just before they immigrated here. I was born here, and I was raised in a very, let's say, European lifestyle. My father being a Polish patriot, as he was in very angry at the state of the world in Eastern Europe, especially that Poland was didn't have a chance for democracy. And in the household, we spoke Polish. And he instilled in me, his son, a great, I guess, love for Poland, even though I never had been there. I didn't go back. I never went to Poland till 2015. 2016, because as a young man, my father kept me from going because I was classed as a Polish citizen, and I would have been taken into the communist army probably. So yeah, short story, that's how my upbringing led me to what I did. I have been doing the last few years for you.
That's really some good context and background for what we're going to talk about today. It really is relevant. And you talk about your dad's military background, you have that as well. And before we get into that interesting story and very remarkable volunteer background, I'm going to ask you this. You know why. You know the answer very distinctly, I'm sure, and why it's important to you. But how far is it from Krakow, Poland, to Kiev, Ukraine?
According to the route we're picking, we were the Eurovelo route number 4. It's about 900 kilometers.
All right. So for our listeners, what's with that route that you picked? Let's talk about the ride.
Well, I was looking myself, because this was my personal idea when I came back from Ukraine 2 years, November, this coming November, it'll be 2 years. So this idea sprouted in my head that to inspire the growing number of Ukrainian amputees, it'd be great to raise funds. I know they're short on prosthetics and prosthetic technicians. So I said, wow, a ride would be great. I'm a paracyclist. Show them that anything's possible. It's all here. It's not your body that restricts you. It's your mental attitude. And if I can do it at my age, anybody can do it. And because of my contacts and from working over there 2 years ago, we were all my Polish friends are centered living around the Krakow area. So I said, what about we cycle? I cycle, I thought, cycle from Krakow, cycle to Kyiv, the capital, because you can tell Ukrainian amputees, oh, there's this crazy paracyclist Canadian. He's going to cycle and fundraise for you 1,000 kilometers, round it off. But it wouldn't have the effect unless I did it there. They'd hear about it and they go, well, it's another, somebody raising money for us, for Ukrainian war effort, and that big deal. But if they see me do it, if they see me cross the border and willing to take the risks that a war entails and Ukrainian drivers entail, which I'm more afraid of than anything Russian, that would inspire them. Riding through towns and villages, because there's not a town, village, homestead in that country that's not been affected by the war.
So you said at your age, so let's share that. How old are you?
I'll be 67 in the fall.
And 900 kilometers, I think you said, miles or kilometers?
Yeah. Well, if I was training here in Canada with, the good road conditions and relative safety, that'd be like 9 days for me, less 7 to 9 days of riding.
But it won't be that
It
there.
won't be that there. I'm leaving on May 31st from Canada to go to Poland, where my first job over there is to get in a car with a friend of mine that's assisting with the ride, a Polish friend, and we're driving the route. Because no one could tell me what, like, I know the road to Lviv, because I worked in that area 2 years ago, and it's a good highway, but I don't know what I'll be dealing with as I f head farther east.
Right.
And I want to see the roads. I want to not just the road condition, but the width and that. We might have to modify the route to accommodate the fact that, I'm a one-legged cyclist. The way I ride is I don't wear a prosthetic. I pedal with one leg, and I have a cycling pod, like a socket attached to my seat post, which I slip my stump into, and I pedal with one leg that distance. So, you'd like to have some shoulder, a bit of a leeway in regards to the pavement. The gentleman that's coming along as my driver, in a camper we've been offered, he's ridden most driven a lot of the roads between Lviv and Kyiv, because he's been there tw over 2 summers during the war, and he says the roads are still in pretty good condition between Lviv and Kyiv. So hopefully, once I see it, there won't be too many detours that we make to hit a good road. Though I do expect to be making detours if I find out that there's an orphanage, a medical facility where amputees are being rehabilitated or in treatment. I'll make a detour and go see them on my bike.
You referred earlier to Ukrainian drivers and how that could be quite dangerous. For most of us, we're not thinking about Ukrainian drivers in Ukraine right now. And I'd certainly be remiss as a journalist if I didn't ask you, what about the war that's going on? What kind of danger would you perceive yourself or risk taking here?
In that regard, like I just heard today that Kharkiv was hit again. Lviv is relatively a safe city. Like I used to do, we used, when I was there 2 years ago, We would take weekends where we could sleep on a real bed and have a shower and a real shower, instead of living the way we were living in warehouses or schools. You would, when we were there, you'd hear the sirens, and in the village I was working in Ukraine, there was nowhere to go, so you just kept working. And we were working, doing renovations to an old building to make a new medical center for this town when I was there before. Regarding the Russians, I'm a fatalist. If it's my time to go, it's my time to go, whether I'm in Ukraine or here. If it's doing something worthwhile, then it's, I'm not going to worry about it, and I'll let my maker deal with the consequences if it was really worthwhile. I'm not afraid of the war itself. I'm afraid of, like I said, Ukrainian drivers, because I'll be dealing with them more consistently, because it's pretty hairy on the roads there. The rules of the road have sort of disappeared. And they're supplying the troops, getting humanitarian aid in, and people are still going on with their everyday lives, right? And the paradox in vehicles there is phenomenal. You'll see a $100,000 Mercedes flying down the road, followed by a 60-year-old Lada that can barely go 40 kilometers an hour, and then a family going to church pulled by a horse and cart.
Is that right? Wow.
And I'll have to maneuver around all that. So that's why I'm happy I will have a vehicle, a camper, and my driver, Stephen, who I met over there 2 years ago, he's from the UK. He'll be like behind me, with four ways on, and I'll be tucked in, hopefully, in front of them. And when I'm over there, because I have so much preparation time, almost 3 months before the actual ride, we'll be getting in contact with the authorities in Ukraine and giving them a heads up. And the cycling groups. We're going to put the word out to any cycling clubs that come along and keep me company between towns and let me draft off them a bit.
Sure. Yeah. To fill in the blanks a little bit, and you referred to humanitarian aid, but you were there on a humanitarian mission recently, and you had referred to refurbishing old buildings into, I think, a medical facility. And then, if I understand right, some R&R, rest and relaxation time, took you to Lviv, where that's where the real impact of seeing other amputees, as you've described, without prosthetic devices, but on crutches or even not. And that had a real impact on you. Did it not? Do I understand that right?
I went over there as a volunteer with an American organization that only took veterans. And they were in dire need of anyone that spoke either Russian, Polish, or Ukrainian. I speak Polish, so I applied. I did not expect to be called up and asked, because you admit that you're an above-knee amputee, and like the chances of them taking on somebody to a war zone, I thought were minimal. But within 2 weeks, I got a call from a re retired U.S. Air Force flight sergeant, and after the interview online, she asked me when could I leave. So I left almost within the month, and ended up in eventually translating for their office on the border, then working with a Polish group transporting humanitarian aid into Lviv. And also on the border at that time, the border was overcrowded. People were still lined up, eh? Like I remember one day we were checking tractor trailers that would take a week to cross the border. 18 kilometers long, they were parked along the highway. But we got, because there was a number, several of us vets had construction experience, we were asked to renovate old offices in a village called Nahachiv in the Lviv Oblast and convert them into a medical center. And we started that project on July 4th, 2 years ago. And I left October 31st. I was the last one to leave. And we lived in pretty rough conditions. Like Nahachiv was a very poor little village of 3,500 people with no infrastructure. So at first we lived on worn out old cots in the school over the summer. And they made our shower in the old scullery, which worked great for the able-bodied guys, but me hopping around pushing an old metal chair to get under the water and out safely was not the safest way to take a shower. But on the weekends, we either went back to Poland to do our laundry and such, or we went to Lviv, which was about 100 kilometers down the highway. And Lviv is the home, it was like a liberty town for the Ukrainian military. By liberty, I mean leave, you know, week 48-hour pass leaves, family leaves. And you'd see a lot of military personnel there. And it's also the whole area is full of army bases now, but also several hospitals that have been converted to military hospitals. And, you know, it was quiet. Lviv is a beautiful city, very inexpensive to entertain yourself. You know, hotel rooms were the equivalent of like 75 Canadian a night. And you wouldn't get a hotel room like that for 700 a night here. And I was walking around the old town, the old city, with my colleagues and even my son who came to work with us. He's a carpenter in France. And I'd be seeing these new amputees, still with bandages on maybe a, you know, a day pass out of the hospital or that. And they were all with crutches. There was upper extremity and lower extremity amputees. And here I'm walking around with my, you know, microprocessor knee and walking pretty well. And they're staring at me. And I remember one young man in particular. I think he was with his parents. And he was an AK. And he was on crutches, and we were in the main square of Lviv. It's all surrounded with restaurants and buskers and singing and all very patriotic. You know, the Ukrainian flag everywhere, and humanitarian aid workers milling around, all the languages, you know, English with every accent imaginable, you know. And this young man stopped dead. And he stared at me as I'm walking. And I did not have the courage to stop and talk to him. One, my Ukrainian isn't the best. But I could see this something in his eyes that almost like he had been going with his folks, his father on one side, his mother on the other. I assume that's who they were. They were much older, my age. And his head was down, you know, like a dejected look. He wasn't paying attention to all the activity in the square. But when he saw me, he picked up, you know, looked up right away and stared at. And I didn't. I regret not stopping to talk to him. I could have found somebody bilingual there, you know, and just, you know, give him hope, give him, say anything's possible. And it bothered me. And then I would be, you know, I went to the hospital once. I had problems with my socket. And they had to fix my socket, and I ended up in the Army hospital. And I saw the facilities they had. They were working out of a container in a room the size maybe 10 by 10. The container was for the molding, doing the actual, you know, the test sockets and making sockets. But that was, they didn't have the facilities. And then I read articles that when the war started, they only had 200 prosthetists and technicians in the whole country. And several months ago, they were looking at over 20-some thousand new amputees.
Wow.
And a lot of them are bilaterals.
Incredible.
And so when I came home, I was the guilt for not talking to the young man ate at me. And I came up with this idea to show them that nothing's impossible. To ride. I'm a cyclist. It took me 3 years to learn to ride one-legged, but I did it. And all it takes is the willingness to do it. And me doing a ride here and putting it on YouTube or whatever and letting, you know, getting it over to them, the majority of them would never see it. Would never know about it, that this guy is riding for Ukrainians, fundraising to get them prosthetics or like I'm linked up with several, a Canadian prosthetic NGO and an American one that do work over in Ukraine. But if they see me do it in their country, then that'll make an impact.
Yeah. Yeah, that's authentic, right? And that's not arm's length volunteer work, let alone putting yourself at risk and at danger. And no doubt, Jacob, I mean, that one person I can see and hear in your voice, it's still upsetting to you, but think how many more you're going to impact.
Yeah, I hope so. When I thought of this, I was alone, and my Polish friend, my close friend, and he is on a board of a Polish NGO for the Ukrainians. And he said, yeah, I'll talk to everybody that you know over here and about the ride. And they came back and said it was a good idea. But I didn't realize setting up a ride in a foreign country in a war zone would be so complicated. I thought I would just get over there, take my bike, jump on the bike, and go for a ride.
Did you?
It's not that way. So first, I reached out to an organization I met over there, a prosthetic NGO, an American one. The Polish group I was affiliated with on the Polish-Ukrainian border that summer, they brought me back from the job in Ukraine one weekend. They said, Jacob, you could have gotten back. So-and-so is coming through the town with a truck, jump in the truck. You're spending the weekend at the warehouse. We got somebody you want to meet. We want you to meet tonight. And it was a person from the United States, a Polish and American woman, with an organization that repurposes used prosthetics. They tear them down, clean them up, and repurpose them. And they were using the Polish organization I was with, attached to ship it to Odessa. They had a bunch of prosthetics that were parts to go to Odessa. So I met this young woman, we talked, and she was just fascinated that, you know, there's a guy that's an amputee that's doing construction work and warehouse work in over here, and he's an amputee. And when I got back to Canada and figured out I needed more help, this ride was going to entail more than me getting my bike over, jumping on the bike and going for a ride. I reached out to this group in New York City, and they tentatively said, we're on board. Then I found a Canadian group called Victoria Hand Project out of Victoria, BC, that do 3D printed upper extremity stuff. And they were on board, but because of issues, they couldn't commit financially to it. So I kept, when they couldn't commit financially, they kept asking me, what am I going to do? Am I going to give up? I was going to do this ride last year. I said, no, I'm not giving up. Regardless of what you people decide as organizations, I'm doing this. I got a bunch of Polish friends over there and a Brit that's willing to follow me in some sort of vehicle to make sure, you know, I'm okay at the end of the day. And if need be, I'll sleep in schools. I'll sleep in barns. But I want people to see me ride. And I don't know if it's my stubbornness or whatever. People that I used to work with in Ukraine 2 years ago came to me and said, we want to help. So from that, we got a Ukrainian-Canadian filmmaker. Well, she immigrated to Canada a number of years ago from Halifax, and she's part of the team, and she did a promotional video, which is on YouTube. And we've got now the commitment for logistical support, if not financial support, for the ride. And in logistical support, a lot the most expensive things were handled, will be handled with another American group. If I may mention these groups by name.
Yeah, please.
The American group that repurposes prosthetics is called Penta Prosthetics out of New York City. When I came back a year ago, I shipped 16 boxes of used prosthetic parts that I tore down that were donated to me from two clinics here in London.
Well, you've got quite a support system, you know. And
yeah, it's just to get the word out and get the money in.
Right. Well, I remember with the Man in Motion, Rick Hansen's Around the World tour, it didn't really start seeing donations till he got back to Canada.
That's our hope.
Yeah, and the momentum started. So, yeah, I guess there's some miles you need to cover, well, figuratively and literally.
Stephen, the Brit that will be driving, he's like the now the leading force in dealing with NGOs and promotions, and like I'm just the guy riding the bike. I'm the probably the least important aspect of this logistically. The most important aspect of this ride are the Ukrainian amputees, both civilian and military. Our hope is for the ride to generate interest after. You know, they'll be filming me as I ride, which will be probably pretty, you know, little snippets of me getting on and off the bike at the end of the day. Who wants to follow a one-legged cyclist for 6 hours? But more importantly, we'll be doing hopefully stops where we can highlight the lives and experiences of the actual amputees in Ukraine.
Yeah. You know, talking about amputees, you being one yourself, as you mentioned, above knee, I just wanted to touch on that briefly, because that's kind of an interesting story as well. You were in the military, injured, and stop me if I when I get this wrong, honorably discharged for medical reasons. And then fast forward 30 years and you still have that injured knee,
yeah,
right? Then you chose electively to have it.
Well, what happened was I was in the military. I had an injury that resulted in me having a patellectomy. They removed my kneecap. I was infantry. And the military organization I was in has this, this was at a time where their philosophy was, if you can't be an infantryman, you can't be in our organization. And I was forced to take a discharge and I came back home to Canada. And that's when I took up cycling because I couldn't run anymore. It was too painful. And I took up cycling. I rode for a number of years. I would have surgeries on my knee. It was an injured knee, on and off. But by about 1990, so this is from 1980s, early 80s, to 1998, I couldn't ride a bike anymore. My condition got so much worse. And in 2001, I had my first knee replacement. June 2001, and by December 2013, I had my sixth And at that time, just the last three were in a revisions, total knee revisions were in 26 months period. And my leg just sort of said, I've had enough. And there were complications, and I got my wish.
Well, I read that you said, and again, I want to get this right, that your amputation led to a vastly superior quality of life than but before the amputation. And yeah. I'm understanding what you mean by that, but probably the pain and the lack of function. But is there another level to that? Did it change your life in a different way?
It made me more grateful and appreciative of what I have and what I'm capable of. And I look at it this way. My quality of life deteriorated from 1998. When I couldn't ride a bike, my psychological health deteriorated. I couldn't train as much. And I kept modifying my lifestyle to keep my training. And I was an endurance athlete by that way. So I was trying to figure out ways to keep it up. And as my knee got worse and we were trying these knee replacements and, you know, you'd have the high of immediately post knee replacement and you're doing well in rehab. And as the months progressed, my condition worsened. And, you know, they'd say, well, you've had so many surgeries by this time. I'm looking at over 12, 13 knee surgeries. You develop a lot of scar tissue. You got this issue. Mentally and physically, my quality of life just got really worse. And then all of a sudden, after the fourth failed knee revision, total knee, I begged my surgeon to amputate. And he refused. And we had a heated discussion about it, and I stormed out. And then, I suffered with the deterioration of the knee. And I went back to him, and he said, let's try again. Are you willing to try again? I said, yes. And that one failed within a few months. And then we had the sixth. And for years, I was living on opioids. Hmm. And I never abused them because they frightened me so much. But I didn't realize I'd run into a doctor from Eastern Europe, a former doctor who was a EMS, a paramedic here in Canada, because he couldn't work as a doctor. And he asked me what I was taking. This is when I had a leg for my pain. And I told him, and he said, you know, in my home country, we found out that that caused a lot of psychological problems, extended use of these kinds of drugs, including anger management problems, and which I was dealing with at the time. Like I joined the United States Marine Corps, where they take angry young men and make them angrier. My quality of life, every aspect of my life, even though I wasn't abusing the drug, was deteriorating. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't do what I loved, which was cycling. I rock climb, you know, stuff like that. The more adventurous stuff. And I was in such a deep depression, I felt liberated when I had the amputation. You know, my first question to the doctor was after the amputation was, is the stump long enough for a prosthetic? When he said yes, in the months I was in the rehabilitation hospital in Toronto, I worked hard to walk out of there well. And then I was awarded, the microprocessor knee, and I worked hard on learning how to walk well. And then In the hospital, I don't know what the experience of your readers are or your listeners. When you're in a rehab hospital, they ask you what your goals are as an amputee. And some people is, you know, drive a car again, play with my grandkids, or that. Mine was get on a bike again.
How long did it take you?
Well, I didn't know how you do it. So I was living in Oshawa at the time, and a friend of mine took me for my idea of eye candy, which was to a bike shop, a high-end bike shop in Whitby. And I'm in the bike shop looking at all these bikes, and the bike shop owner had, this was right after the London Olympics, had back issues of a European cycling magazine. And in one of them was an article on the Barcelona amputee, the Spanish amputee Paris cycling team, made up of amputees from Barcelona. And they were AKs, the two champions. Juano Mendez, who was a Spanish champion, he won the world champion in Baie-Comeau 20 years ago. They ride without prosthetics. So I go, well, you know, that's an idea. You know, like I didn't like the idea of wearing a prosthetic, being tangled up in a bike, at least. So, and my stump is relatively short. And so I didn't have money for a bike at that time. And fortunately, somebody told me about the Challenge Athletes Foundation from California. And being a Marine, I get a little bigger grant than civilians do through their Operation Rebound, which allowed me to buy my first road bike. My prostitution in Whitby at DP&O, he made my first cycling pod attachment to my bike for free. And it took me 3 years of riding on the road badly till I got the hang of pulling up on the pedal. I even made a trip to Barcelona and trained with them for a few weeks. Last year, I clocked about, I'll say it in miles because that's the way I'm old fashioned. I did about 14,000 miles last year.
Wow. So that's crowding 20,000 kilometers, probably. That's incredible.
Yeah. I was doing on average in a week 900 kilometers a week.
You are a resourceful man. There's no question about that.
I don't know
that.
If it's resourcefulness or just being bloody stubborn.
Yeah, there's got to be part of that too. And it serves you well, Jacob. That's for sure. Listen, before I let you go, I just want to know, I mean, a lot of time on the bike you spend, I understand. But, you know, when you're not training, what fills the other hours, if there are such a thing in your life?
There aren't many hours left after. When I'm training, even in the winter, my workouts, preparing for this ride, are 5 to 6 hours of cardio, sometimes more. Fortunately, you get to eat a lot and not gain weight after that kind of workout. I eat a lot. I read. I've been asked to participate in another kind of physical challenge, mental challenge in 2025, which we're recruiting amputees for, which is to climb Mount Orizaba in Mexico in November 2025, an amputee team through an outfit in Elora, Ontario.
All right. Well, we can certainly help you promote that to our
I've always wanted to do mountaineering. I do rock climbing. I tried ice climbing with the outfit in Elora. And now mountaineering, that's another thing off my bucket list. It might be the culmination of my bucket list, because if things go wrong, but at least I do it.
Do you even refer to these years as your golden years? Is that it's just not in your
No.
No.
No, like I've had several surgeries post amputation, stump revisions and the osseointegration. I've had issues with phantom pain where we did nerve interfaces, and I always end up in a rehab hospital, and I continue, I've always gone back to the same rehab hospital in Toronto, and they sort of come to accept Jacob as Jacob, and you let him go in the gym and let him do his thing. But the people, new amputees, or that would be in the hospital with me, and I'm talking about Westpark Healthcare because they have their own amputee wing, and we're like a little community, and we have our own physio gym and our own physios there. They would come to me and go, "You're so inspirational. You work so hard and you walk so well, and this." And I go, "No, I'm not the inspiration. This is just who I am. It's who I've been since I went into Marine Corps, and they, repurposed me. They reprogrammed me. They allowed me. The Marine Corps took the exposed who I really was and my capabilities, and I latched on to it, right? I said, the real inspirations are you people when you do a 180. I'm doing what I'm meant to do, what I've done for almost 50 years, 45 years. But when you come in here and you're frightened by your health condition or a traumatic accident, and you decide at this moment, I'm going to turn my life around 180 degrees and live a healthy lifestyle and exercise in this, you are the inspiration because you're doing something that's scary.
Yeah, that's a really good point because we all have our own experience, our own story to tell, our own fears, right?
Yeah, like.
And our own success stories, and that need not be measured against other people and
No, like those are
elite
the,
cyclists like yourself. But
well, no, like they were the inspiration to me.
yeah.
Like I'm doing some, I'm no different. A fish needs water to swim. Well, I need, physical challenges and that stuff to breathe for my existence. These are people that are going contrary to their makeup, physical, mental makeup, and doing a 180 psychologically and physically. And they're overcoming hurdles that I haven't had to deal with for decades.
Yeah.
Anxiety and fears that are associated with that. And they are the inspiration. Common people doing uncommonly challenging things, that is totally against their makeup.
Well, yeah, and what a lot with a traumatic injury, not where we expect it to be all of a
No.
sudden. So, yeah, your ride is that's if it's not inspirational, it's motivational. There's no getting
Well, all
around
I
that.
want to
But
do is let people know that there is hope, and physical limitations are also a doorway to express yourself in new and more, I say, glorious ways.
yeah, wow. What a way to put it. Listen, before I let you go, I want folks to know where they can find the video, the ride video. I've watched it. It's fabulous. And I'm sure the film work and the content that's going to come back from Ukraine is going to be equally as good.
Thanks.
So name of that YouTube video so people could look that up
Well,
on.
it's under Hope Raising Expedition. Hope Raising is one word. And it's on YouTube. It's just me being interviewed and doing a winter workout. You get a little idea of what motivated me to think up of the ride and how I train during the winter. It's all cardio. There's nothing spectacular, just long hours staring at handlebars on a spinning bike or on an elliptical. It's great for my reading because I read as I do these things.
It's not glamorous, is what you're saying, but the video is really good. So, you know, with that, thank you so much for joining me. And I know it was short notice, but I knew we didn't have much time until you left. We wish you all the best safety and health and for your purpose too. I really think that when the momentum picks up in Ukraine and when you get back to Canada, it's going to make a remarkable difference in people's lives. So with that, I say thank you, Jacob. And we talked about where you could learn more at that video on YouTube. Thank you all for being with us today. This has been Life and Limb. Thank you for joining Jacob and I. You can read about others who are thriving with limb loss or limb difference and plenty more at thrivemag.ca. Until next time, live well.
Thank you, Jeff.